From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This program changed a lot after 9/11. Before, we spent a lot of time on cultural issues. After, our focus shifted to freedom of expression and information, privacy, and the First Amendment. And that's where we'll begin this anniversary show. Civil liberties, those freedoms I just mentioned, are conditions that enable good journalism. And they were threatened by our own government after the attacks, as they always are when national security is at risk.
University of Chicago law professor Jeff Stone is the author of Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime from the Sedition Act of 1798 to the War on Terrorism. We asked him to assess the nation's record on civil liberties in the decade following the attacks, and he says it wasn't quite as bad as we may have feared.
Nobody was prosecuted for criticizing the government or the war. There were no mass arrests or detentions of American citizens. We were a bit fast and loose, I think, with aliens from some countries who we saw as potential threats, and that was a mistake. But unlike World War II, where we incarcerated almost 100,000 American citizens of Japanese descent, nobody was talking about incarcerating American Muslims. One of the things that George Bush did was recognizing, for example, that he could not suppress critics, was to be very aggressive about preventing people from learning what the government was doing, because you can't criticize what you don't know. And that's very dangerous to a democracy, for the government to be secretly engaging in a range of activities that would be criticized by members of the American electorate is a denial of self-governance. And the Bush administration did that at every turn.
But the Bush administration was not the end of the story.
So Obama came in, and I think the one dramatic thing he did with respect to secrecy was significantly change the guidelines for classification. After 9/11, Attorney General Ashcroft changed the rules about classification to bring within the web of classified material a much broader set of information than had previously been the case. One of the steps that President Obama took, for which he deserves great credit, was to essentially reverse those changes and to go back to the pre-existing set of standards.
On the other hand, though, there's the invocation of the State Secrets Act that has stymied a good number of court cases.
Yes, the State Secrets Doctrine essentially allows the government, when they're sued, to challenge the constitutionality of some policy, for the government to say, we cannot be required to defend the constitutionality of the policy because for us to do so would require us to reveal classified information. Therefore, the litigation has to be dismissed. And the Obama administration has, in fact, invoked that state secrets privilege as often, if not more often, than any administration in history. There are two other elements to the secrecy issue where I think the Obama administration has done just as poorly. A second has to do with whistleblowing. There is a serious need for expanded protection of government employees who leak information where that information shows government wrongdoing, ineptitude, substantial waste, and the like. Right now, government employees can be jailed if they release information which is important for the public to know. And President Obama supported expanded whistleblower protection before he became president. But since he's been president, he has taken a much more cautious position on that. And the third example has to do with the issue of the journalist source privilege. 49 states and the District of Columbia have a privilege that allows journalists to decline to reveal their confidential sources. There is no federal journalist source privilege. That legislation continues to linger.
In poll after poll, Americans have demonstrated that they are willing to trade a certain amount of their civil liberties for security. And yet, with each public revelation of excess by the government, there has been a political backlash. Waterboarding remains controversial, but the practice stopped. The TIPS program was announced. The backlash was swift and fatal to that program. Is it that the principle of civil freedom is just in our DNA as Americans?
I'd like to think it was in our DNA as Americans, but I think that's a little overstated. Too often it's the case that Americans are more interested in their own liberty than the liberty of someone else. But I do think, on balance, that there has been an increasing awareness and sensitivity along those lines. The Supreme Court, in a series of very often divided decisions in the first 7 years after 9/11, did put clear limits on what the administration can do. And despite all of the to-ing and fro-ing over particular Supreme Court decisions and the like, the Supreme Court does have considerable credibility with the American public.
All that said, that fretting that you and I have both been engaged in over the last decade, were we worried for nothing?
Absolutely not. The fretting, the pushing back, all of that helps define where the fight will be. And in the realm of, say, the post-9/11 world, you want to be fighting over whether there are habeas corpus rights for individuals in Guantanamo, rather than whether the government can intern American citizens who are Muslims. One won't always win on every issue, but what the issue is the most critical question. On that score, I think that the Bush administration was forced to fight out the legality of its actions in a place that was, in the grand scheme of things, relatively modest, whereas Franklin Roosevelt didn't have to fight about anything he did until he got to Japanese internment. And even then, it wasn't much pushback. So I think that the nation behaved extremely well in fulfilling its responsibilities, both the citizens and media and political officials, in pushing back early on so as to prevent us from getting to a place where real tragedies would have occurred.
All right, Jeff. An education, as always.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Jeffrey Stone is a professor at the University of Chicago Law School and author of Speaking Out, Reflections on Law, Liberty, and Justice.
So, taking the long view, America did not roll back basic freedoms to the same degree as it had during earlier perilous times. It is, nevertheless, a fact that authorities, especially law enforcement, still act randomly to quash inconvenient forms of expression in the name of national security. Case in point, a spate of recent instances of police stopping people with cameras from using them for no apparent reason.
The notion that you could enhance national security by limiting photography does not make sense.
Attorney Morgan Manning wrote about several of these cases last year. She says that a never-ending war on terror seems sufficient justification for law enforcement to insist a camera be capped.
After they realize that they really don't have a sound basis for doing this, then they kind of attach, just use a broad statute, you know, obstruction of justice or interfering with a police officer or a statute that's written that could apply to anything but was not really meant to apply to the average person taking a picture.
Take Dwayne Kurzik. Apparently, he likes trains.
Amtrak was actually sponsoring a contest, and it was called Picture Our Trains, I believe, and one individual took a picture of the train, and he was stopped by a security guard hired by Amtrak and told that he was not allowed to take pictures of the train and that it was, you know, they cited to, I think, the 9/11 law.
The 9/11 law?
The 9/11 law.
He just made up the 9/11 law?
Yeah.
Dwayne Kurzik declined our request for an interview, but he did talk about the bizarre episode with Stephen Colbert back in 2009, shortly after his arrest.
My intention when I went to the station that day was just to get a couple of good photos of trains that were shiny.
Shiny. The officers leapt into action.
They searched me, and they then handcuffed me to a wall for about an hour while they figured out what they were going to do.
But you can feel safe, America, because Dwayne Kurzik was arrested.
Yes, I got arrested.
For terrorism.
For trespassing.
Well, they both start with a T.
Emily Good noticed flashing lights in front of her house in Rochester, New York. She went outside to check it out. It was a traffic stop. She decided to record it.
You guys need something?
This is my front yard. I'm just recording what you're doing. It's my right.
Actually, not from the sidewalk.
This is my yard.
The police officer tells Good he doesn't feel safe with her standing behind him, although he doesn't explain why. The confrontation begins to escalate.
All I have is a camera. I'm clearly wearing nothing. I have no weapon.
That does not matter. What you're not listening to our orders right now. We don't feel safe with you standing behind us. You're not moving even a foot further back. You're gonna be.
Do you want me to move a foot further back?
You're going to be under arrest. I already warned you.
I will move a foot further back.
She says, I'm going to back up, and the police officer says,
You you're going to go to jail. That's just not right.
Where's the car?
No, no, no. Stay right here.
I'm observing what they're doing, and they're arresting me. I don't understand what's going on. I did nothing.
Once you're told to stop, and if it's any kind of a dispute between the officer and the individual, the officer charges you with obstruction of justice. It's his word against you. It's a factual issue.
Good was charged with obstruction of governmental administration, but the charges were dropped in July. Morgan Manning.
At that point, even if the charges are dismissed, I mean, she's gone through the hassle and expense and time of litigation. Things like that are not supposed to happen.
Surely you've run across some cases where you thought, okay, the police officer had a reasonable right to be suspicious and to stop the photography.
I've run across cases where the police officers had reason to clear the area. But to tell you the truth, it's not a very reasonable conclusion that someone who is taking pictures poses a national security threat. And furthermore, all of these national exhibits, etc., photographs of them are available on the internet widespread. Google Earth, for example, shows you pretty much any angle of anything that you would like to see.
Of course, the police are entitled to prevent needless risk to themselves when performing their duties. But just last month, the chief of police in Long Beach, California, said that, according to his department's policy, police officers may detain photographers who are taking pictures with, quote, no apparent aesthetic value. Meanwhile, last month, the First Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the Constitution protects the right to videotape a police officer while they're on duty. The tug of war between security and the First Amendment is everlasting.
Coming up, the littlest neocon, how a six-year-old became an avid consumer of conservative media after 9/11.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Hey, can you look out your window right now?
Yeah.
Can you see God about 4,000 feet above 5 East Europa right now? Looks like he's...
Yeah, I see him.
The recording you're listening to is from a conversation between two air traffic controllers on September 11th, 2001 at 9.02 a.m., seconds before the second airplane hit the World Trade Center.
Another one just hit the building.
Wow. Another one just hit the World Trade.
The whole building just came apart.
Holy smokes.
The recording was published this week by Rutgers Law Review, part of a newly public archive of recordings from September 11th. They document the conversations among air traffic controllers, other government workers, and in some cases, the passengers and hijackers on the planes as the events of the day unfold. The recordings don't contain new information exactly. They were gathered by investigators for 2004's 9/11 Commission report. This time is the first time, however, that the audio itself has been released to the public. New York Times reporter Jim Dwyer wrote about the archive. He says that being able to hear the voices gives us a more vivid picture of September 11th. He also says that the recordings reveal an infrastructure that was even more unprepared for the attacks than anybody realized at the time. For instance, Dwyer says that the military barely knew that the hijacked planes were in the air before the Twin Towers had been struck.
The military had notification of one of the four flights, Flight 11, that flew into the Trade Center at 8:46 in the morning, and they had 9 minutes' notice on that, so there was no way they were going to catch up with that flight with 9 minutes' notice. The other flights they learned about after they had already either crashed into the Trade Center or crashed into the Pentagon or out at Shanksville, Pennsylvania.
Something else cleared up by the Rutgers report is the narrative over the shoot-down order, which we had long been told was issued after some agonizing by the president. It turns out what we heard from the government is not what actually took place.
It appears that the only documented shoot-down orders that were given while the hijackings were still in process or while the buildings were still standing, let's even say that, apparently was issued by Vice President Cheney. And when it reached military controllers, and they understood it to have originated with Cheney, they did not pass it along to the fighter pilots. The chain of command calls for that kind of order to come through the Secretary of Defense from the president directly. Now, Cheney and Bush both said that Bush had approved it, but all of the contemporaneous records reflect that there was no conversation between Bush and Cheney on that subject prior to the order being issued. There were later conversations, and indeed there were those orders later transmitted down the line to the pilots, but it was sort of irrelevant at that point because there was no longer hijackers in the air.
One of the most interesting things about the report, at least as I understand it from the piece that you wrote, is not what's in it, but what isn't in it. Tell me what's missing.
One thing that has not been released is the tape of a fairly long and very high-level telephone conference that was held over the entire course of the morning and eventually came to involve Vice President Cheney, Secretary Rumsfeld, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff Vice Chairman Richard Myers. There is an informal transcript made by one of the commission investigators that's online in various places, but there's no authoritative transcript or copy of the tape.
What's the explanation for not permitting them to include this material in the report? Any national security issues that came up?
Exactly why it was classified, I can't say for sure, but Miles Kara, who was an investigator with the 9/11 Commission, a retired Army colonel, who listened to the tape as part of the investigation, said that he believes it's because parts of the conversation include discussions of continuation of the government in the event that certain key figures were killed.
Was there anything else to explain why the White House put the kibosh on its release?
You know for sure that the shoot-down order did not go through the chain of command from this conference. You also know that various other escalating orders, like going to DEFCON 3, that did not take place until 11 o'clock.
So it impeaches the administration's narrative of what took place that morning.
It does impeach the administration's narrative to some extent, but at this point, the commission, having heard the reality, you know, that information is out. And so keeping the tape secret seems like pointless at this time.
Doesn't that bring us right back around to where we started this conversation about the impact of the audio in adding a dimension to what we already well understood?
Yes, you can read a transcript of this, and it's a flat, one-dimensional experience. If you read a narrative that says, now you are going to hear an air traffic controller try to get in touch with a military commander, those pieces working in tandem have a great deal of power and historical value.
Hi, Boston Center TMU. We have a problem here. We have a hijacked aircraft headed towards New York, and we need you guys to, we need someone to scramble some F-16s or something up there to help us out.
Is this real world or exercise?
No, this is not an exercise, not a test.
Okay, hey, hold on one second, okay?
Yep.
You know, when they had the hearings on the Titanic, they had the Morse code guys from all the other ships come in with their records. What did they write down? What messages did they get? It's that experience of the actual contemporaneous, indisputable document that the audio brings to the history.
All right, Jim. Thanks very much, and thanks for your story.
You're welcome.
Jim Dwyer is a columnist for the New York Times and author of 102 Minutes, The Unforgettable Story of the Fight to Survive in the Twin Towers.
After September 11th, the Bush administration condemned Al Jazeera, the Doha-based Arabic-language TV news network, for its airing of bin Laden tapes and images of captured American soldiers. But this year's Arab Spring marked a sharp change in America's opinion of the channel. Online viewership rose 2,500%, with more than half of that increase coming from the U.S. Still, Al Jazeera English, which launched in 2006 to great success worldwide, struggles to get picked up by U.S. cable companies, a problem it's been addressing with an email campaign, Demand Al Jazeera. Since that campaign is gaining steam, we offer this case study of what happened when Al Jazeera came to Vermont. Andrew Stelzer reports.
If you want to watch Al Jazeera English on cable TV, well, odds are you're out of luck. Just four cable systems in the U.S. currently carry it. New York City became the most recent this August, when Al Jazeera was able to sublease 23 hours a day from another station on Time Warner Cable. They have a similar arrangement in Washington, D.C. The only carriers which carry the channel outright are Buckeye Cable in Toledo, Ohio, and Burlington Cable in Vermont. Burlington was the first, beginning in January 2007, and it wasn't without a struggle.
And so here, all of a sudden, Al Jazeera, self-admitted, notorious, controversial station, is here without anyone having a say.
Jeffrey Kaufman was one of several Burlington residents who began to complain soon after Al Jazeera came on air. Kaufman says he believes the Arab network is providing a platform for hate, anti-Semitism, and is what he calls a, quote, soft sell tool to help spread Sharia, or strict Islamic law. To make his case, Kaufman points to videos from Al Jazeera's Arabic language station, which plays different content than the English channel.
At this part, we're at, "Oh Allah, take the," speaking of the Jews, "Oh Allah, take this oppressive, tyrannical band of people. Oh Allah, do not spare a single one of them. Count their numbers and kill them down to the very last one."
On screen, a man is giving a sermon about the 2009 invasion of Gaza.
This is Sheikh Yusuf Qaradawi, regularly featured on Al Jazeera. I mean, this is very scary stuff.
In 2008, complaints by Kaufman and others found the ear of Burlington Telecom's general manager, Chris Burns, who announced he would take Al Jazeera off the air. But that move also got the station's supporters up off the couch. Hundreds of people came out to a set of hearings scheduled by Burlington Telecom's advisory committees, held in City Hall and at a local college.
We're here tonight because there is a small group of people who don't like the fact that Al Jazeera exists and that millions of people around the world watch it.
This xenophobic paranoia of Islam is totally unwarranted. And for those who are offended by the program, just switch channels.
In several hours of testimony, Al Jazeera's supporters far outnumbered those opposed. An investigation about claims of anti-Semitic programming or support of terrorism also came up empty, and the station was kept on the air.
Well, I always say it is a question for me of when, not if.
Al Anstey, managing director of Al Jazeera English, says the network is in talks with several major cable companies. Anstey says misconceptions about the station have been consigned to history, but at this point, that's probably a bit optimistic. Don Rojas is the executive director of Free Speech TV, a satellite station which airs Al Jazeera English's programming for 2.5 hours a day.
There's still that stigma hanging over Al Jazeera, that they are supposedly the channel of the terrorists. And, you know, they have not been able to really shake that image fully in the U.S. and among U.S. media executive decision makers.
But coming into its own this year with coverage of the Arab revolutions has made Al Jazeera's news value undeniable.
Well, let's go back now to one of our top stories here on Al Jazeera, and that's the protests, of course, in Tunisia.
Al Jazeera's Ayman Mohideen joins us now on the phone from Cairo.
It does not seem
neither the government nor the protesters are willing to give up. Omar Saleh, Al Jazeera, Ramtha, on the Jordan-Syria border.
Back in Vermont, Burlington College teacher Sandy Baird assigned students in her American Foreign Policy and Cities of the World classes to watch the Arab Spring unfold on Al Jazeera.
I was really surprised because my students are pretty politically apathetic, but through watching Al Jazeera, they really got addicted to the whole happenings in the Middle East, as well as a lot of other places, Latin America, and coverage of Venezuela and Chavez and Cuba, and they're really fascinated in how different it is than the other networks.
Senior Nicholas Locito was one student who instantly noticed that difference.
While CNN and all these, like, American broadcasting centers were talking about Charlie Sheen, Al Jazeera was talking about the revolutions that were happening in the Middle East. And that's a bona fide fact. it was almost like the revolutions were a break from the Charlie Sheen coverage. And I'm just like, I really don't care about that at all.
Taking a gamble that others think like Locito, the Demand Al Jazeera campaign is targeting college students. They invited summer interns in Washington to visit their D.C. studios and are holding national Call Your Cable Provider Days on college campuses. The hope is exposure to the content and the culture of Al Jazeera will overturn stereotypes that have built up over the past decade. For On the Media, I'm Andrew Stelzer in Burlington, Vermont.
Al Jazeera is news seen through a different cultural and historical lens than American news, and that's good. Variety is a vital part of a healthy media diet. 16-year-old Brendan Illis has been gorging on news since at least the age of six, when the Twin Towers fell. When WNYC's Radio Rookies, a program that teaches kids how to tell their own stories, put out a call for personal tales of 9/11, Brendan answered because 9/11 and news has played a big role in the direction of his life.
I'm driving with my mom from her home in suburban New Jersey. Like most of my friends, I just got my permit. But in a lot of ways, I'm different.
When you were in pre-K, the one thing that you wanted to do when you were a grown-up was watch the news.
As soon as I was old enough, I started reading the newspaper.
And you didn't start with the comics like most kids do.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language.
I also listened to a lot of conservative talk radio, and my parents begrudgingly allowed it.
The radical Muslim world has declared war on America. We are at war.
9/11 was my introduction to politics, world diplomacy, war, the economy. It affected everything. I may have been the youngest neocon ever.
This is your Pearl Harbor.
Members of the commission, your staff has developed initial findings to present to the public on the nature of the enemy.
In fourth grade, I even recorded the 9/11 commission hearings on the cassette tapes, so I could hear them when I got home from school.
We will focus on Al-Qaeda's history and evolution.
At school, I'm known as the walking history book. I take it as a compliment.
He was the spiritual leader of Al-Qaeda.
Most kids my age don't really think about how 9/11 changed our country. I wish they did. The effort they put into gossiping and sneaking out, I put into researching politics and current events. Last year, I started a blog. It's like a direct line into my head. I posted this question to my followers. Do you think 9/11 affected our generation?
We don't care as much as we should.
This girl I've never met in person responded.
My name's Anna, and I'm from Phoenix, Arizona.
Can you tell me quick, how you met me?
Over a blogging site called Tumblr.
Anna told me about one time when Tumblr crashed, which it does a lot.
When it came back up, people were posting pictures of the Twin Towers saying, oh, Tumblr crashed, and they're saying, it's the same thing, but it's nowhere near it.
It's awful. They were comparing the deaths of almost 3,000 people to a website crashing for a couple of days. Maybe I take the World Trade Center attacks more seriously, because we talk about that kind of stuff in my family.
Please don't eat with your fingers.
Like one night at dinner.
There's a difference between hearing that 1,000 people died and actually seeing images of people jumping to their deaths because they have no hope of survival.
My parents always give us answers, even to difficult questions. My 10-year-old sister Catherine just learned about 9/11 from a documentary she saw on TV.
Would you rather die by jumping out a window or from a fire?
I don't know. Honestly, hope I'm never put in that position. But to know that the people in that building, many of them were in that position, is just heartbreaking.
I'm in the youngest group of people who remember 9/11. As a 16-year-old who gets it, I fear that people younger than me won't understand and it'll lose its importance. If we let our guard down, it could happen again.
Just say hello.
Hi.
I'm with my little sister Catherine in the back seat of the car.
Can you tell me how old you were when 9/11 happened?
I wasn't even one. I was zero.
Do you think it had a pretty big effect on you?
Not really.
The world didn't change for Catherine on September 11th. She's never known anything else.
Well, it was big to other people. It was big, but not to my life.
My other sister, Sarah, thinks we talk about it too much.
So you have no specific memories of that day?
No. You think I haven't thought about this before?
I've tried to remember.
So you don't.
I don't even remember having you as a brother when I was 3.
She's starting high school this year.
It's like the past, but it shouldn't be like the main event, like the focus of the country.
Like a lot of people in my generation, she thinks of 9/11 as a singular event, but I can't look at it that way. 9/11 was the first news story I ever really followed. I would hear Michael Savage mention a person or an agency on his show and I would be like, well, I don't know what that is. So I'd look it up. And I would go from one internet search to the next. Then Savage changed his broadcast time, so I started trolling the internet for his substitute show and found a whole new world of information. So 9/11 wasn't a singular event for me. It's a road, one I'm still walking down today. For On the Media, I'm radio rookie Brendan Illes.
Brendan Illes' story comes to us courtesy of WNYC's Radio Rookies.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at GatesFoundation.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at MacFound.org. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. After the attacks, nothing really seemed funny. David Letterman's monologue from his first show after 9/11 perfectly captured how many comedians were feeling.
You can feel it. You can see it. It's terribly sad. Terribly, terribly sad. And watching all of this, I wasn't sure that I should be doing a television show, because for 20 years we've been in the city making fun of everything, making fun of the city. To come to this circumstance that is so desperately sad, I don't trust my judgment in matters like this.
That week, I hosted a call-in show with then Saturday Night Live's Will Ferrell. Ferrell was most famous at the time for his savage impersonations of President Bush on Saturday Night Live.
So what's my secret? I don't know. Most of good genes, I guess. And plenty of sleep. 14 hours a night. Every night, no ifs, ands, or buts. Also, keeping a moderate work schedule and taking frequent catnaps.
We decided to rerun that conversation with Will Ferrell this week, who told me that back then, the writer's room at Saturday Night Live was filled with people who, like Letterman, no longer trusted their judgment.
Yeah, the one place you'd think maybe there would be some tasteless jokes, we weren't coming up with them. Yeah.
So what happened? Yeah. Did you set some ground rules? Did you say, okay, first off, no Bush jokes?
Well, I think the political and topical humor that we're usually known for, we're going to have to kind of keep our foot off the gas pedal for a while. I guess we'll be making fun of celebrities. You can always do that, right? Yeah.
That's fair game.
Right.
The fact is that nobody really seems to care about celebrities right now.
Yeah.
This is the time of the genuine working class hero.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it may be for those of us in humor our one salvation to still be able to tell, I don't know, the cast of Friends type of jokes. We're beginning to enter a new era for so many different things, including comedy, you know. And watching David Letterman last night, he even said it himself, he's based his whole thing on making fun of things and people, especially in New York, and it's just not appropriate right now.
So, yeah. I mean, where is comedy in this country, and especially in the city and on Saturday Night Live, if irony is suddenly off limits?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. I don't know if we're going to be going back to literally the days of vaudeville, and we're just going to be doing slapstick and, you know, slipping on banana peels on stage.
But who's going to laugh at that?
Probably no one. But but we'll be trying. I don't know. I don't know. And who knows if anyone will be laughing at anything. So
how will you know it's time to get back and make fun of stuff again?
I guess by baby steps, you've already sensed that there's a slight return to normalcy here in
the city. Well, David Letterman did make fun of Regis Philbin.
That's what you call a baby step.
Right.
And if every 2 weeks there's another horrible news story, you're still not going to want to yuck it up. So
I'd like to bring in Deborah now in Manville, New Jersey. Thank you very much for coming on.
Oh, thank you for the program. I really felt very compelled to call. I find that we really and truly do need some humor right now. I believe in laughter as part of the healing process.
If Will Ferrell went into his famous George Bush imitation, could you still find it funny?
No, I don't think so. And as Will was saying, it's tough.
So you want to laugh, but you don't know what you can laugh at right now.
True. Very, very true.
Yeah, well, I think the humor will go back to more just observational humor about just quirky things in life and silly characters that aren't based in reality at all.
So you see the resurgence of Shecky Green?
Yeah. Maybe just a lot of knock-knock jokes.
Hello, America. It's me, George W., your president. And in a few weeks, I won't be able to say that. I know, it's sad, but change is necessary. Without change, we'd all wear the same clothes every day and only watch the movie Tango and Cash. So I'm leaving the White House to go tear Dallas a new party hole. But don't worry, the Tiger Woods guy is taking over. And he seems to know a lot of stuff. But here's the thing.
That was comedian Will Ferrell. Comedian Mark Maron was living in New York on 9/11, and he saw the towers go down. He realized there was no time like the present to make jokes. Mark, thanks for coming on.
Sure.
At the time, there was a lot of talk about the end of irony, and although it's easy to look back and say, ugh, how naive we were, did you suspect at the time that perhaps we were entering a fundamentally unfunny era?
No, I never thought that. I knew it was only a matter of weeks before things got funny again. In the sense that, you know, comedy has always been used to diffuse fear and horror and uncertainty. It doesn't just go away. It becomes even more necessary.
Did you talk with other comedians about when it was too soon and when it was time?
The people I was hanging out with, we never thought about that. Let's do it immediately. You know, we're in the trenches here. We were in New York City. We had to reckon with it. I mean, there was a period there where you couldn't even go below 14th Street, really, unless you lived there. And as soon as comedy clubs started functioning again, we were out doing it. And, you know, they haven't found most of the bodies. You can still smell the thing burning. Are we going to stand up on stage and act like it's not happening down the street? So we weren't afforded that time.
But you've said since then that the laughter was just strange, something you hadn't encountered before.
Right. Well, that was because we were in these clubs. I remember it was the Comedy Cellar, I think, where I really started to do stand-up again. And people were wandering in. It was almost as if they had no idea where to go with their feelings. They had no idea where to go with their anger and their pain and just the horror of it. I mean, at that time, there were pictures of missing people all over New York. It was a collage of this horror. And people would wander in and they'd sit down. And I don't know that they knew even why they were there other than to find something to distract them from what we were living in at that moment. And the laughter came quickly. You'd do jokes and it'd be like, ah, there was terror in it. And then it would go away very quickly. I'll just never forget that. You know, you drop a punchline, you'd be like, ah, and then it would stop abruptly. And you realize that nothing I'm going to say up here is going to create any comfort that they're going to be able to walk out of this club with. That what they're here for is a very intense need for relief in this moment. And that is the best we can do here. So the audiences at that time were something I'd never experienced before, and I'll never forget it.
Let's play one of your earliest jokes post 9/11. It's essentially about pain.
A few months ago, I was on the road, you know, and I'd be like, yeah, I live in New York. And you're like, oh, really? I mean, New York City was like the girl at the office who got raped. People are like, oh, we heard what, oh, yeah. Is there a everything okay? You doing okay? All right, well, you know, we just wanted to let you know that we saw it from across the way and there was nothing we could do. We're just glad you're okay.
Can you take us back to the moment when you were writing that joke? What went through your mind?
Well, all you heard about was, like, you know, a nation is coming together. You know, I even had family members who just wanted to flock to Ground Zero. It was almost a magnetic attraction to tragedy. But I thought that a lot of people were coming from the Midwest to rubberneck, and that they were flocking here to sort of politicize this thing, to make it about religion and about nationalism and about everything else. I felt that there was an agenda to this gawking, and it made me angry. And just that weird, condescending, sympathetic tone of people approaching you when they hear you're from New York, and it was just like, oh my God.
The earliest, most stunning bit of 9/11 humor, so to speak, would have been the late September issue of The Onion, what's called the blanking, we'll bleep it, what's called the holy f- issue that showed the burning towers and featured such headlines as "Real Life Resembles Bad Jerry Bruckheimer Movie." You had an interview with Todd Hansen, who was the lead writer of The Onion at the time. Let's play a little bit of that tape.
The story that people always talk about that issue was not on the front page, which was God angrily clarifies, don't kill rule. And he was saying, look, I've been saying this for thousands of years. How much more can I explain it? You're pissing me off now. Quit it.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And at the end of that story, you know, God actually starts crying. And I was actually crying when I wrote that. I mean, it was funny, cry more than funny, ha ha.
Right.
Normally, The Onion loves to be irreverent, and we love to get hate mail. And we did get a lot of hate mail right at the beginning of the day. But then throughout the day, we started getting hundreds and hundreds more, eventually thousands of emails. And 90% of them were not only supportive, they were like ecstatic. They were saying things like, God bless The Onion. You know, thank you, The Onion.
Right.
Thank you for giving me the first laugh I've had in, you know, a week and a half.
I mean, this was so early after the event, and yet they waded right into it. What was your reaction?
That was the truth of how everybody was feeling. You know, outside of the pain of loss or the pain of uncertainty or the fear of uncertainty, that was the immediate feelings that everybody had. I think it enabled people to have a little bit of distance and get a little bit of a laugh, but I don't think it really trivialized what happened.
Todd Hansen told you that he didn't want to, quote, question the establishment when the establishment lay in burning embers at our feet. But there was a lot of subversive humor to follow. One of them is the classic trope, if I don't blank, then the terrorists win. And here we have David Cross doing one of those.
You just see all these guys, like, you read this thing in the paper, you'd be in, like, Houston, Texas, and be like, you know, we seriously considered not doing our show after the events of the 11th, and we had a meeting. We were like, guys, should we do the show? And then we all said, no, we shouldn't. And then I stood up and I said, uh-uh, guys, no. If Houston's own Assaulted Nuts improv group doesn't perform, then the terrorists have truly won. And we were like, yeah, that's right. The Assaulted Nuts will perform. Like Osama bin Laden's going, please tell me the Assaulted Nuts are not performing. No, what must I do? What more must I do?
So there were a lot of jokes like that.
Well, how people take ownership of that tragedy and how that tragedy is used for individual gain or political gain or even marketing gain was heinous. And taking ownership for 9/11 or using it for cultural traction is definitely something that deserves to be satirized. And I think he did it in a very funny way.
Is there a 10-year 9/11 joke, or is it just not relevant anymore?
Well, if it's not relevant anymore, it's because it's been beaten to death one way or the other through humor and through politics. It's a good question. It's obviously relevant as something we all lived through. It actually came up on stage the other night. I'd done a setup to a joke where I say I almost killed two people. And there's no reason to laugh there, but some woman stage right just started laughing. I'm like, what's wrong with you? I mean, there's no joke there. Is it just funny, the idea that I almost killed people? And somehow, like, I'd built on it to the point where I got the Holocaust involved. I said, is that funny to you? And then people were still laughing because I was sort of attacking this woman. And then when I said 9/11, it was like, whoa. So I think it does still represent a tremendous pain in this country's cultural fabric.
Mark, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Mark Maron is a comedian and host of the WTF with Mark Maron podcast.
Perhaps you remember Dan Rather, 1, 2, 3, 4 anchors back at the CBS Evening News. In September 2001, he was not deemed, as had been his predecessor Walter Cronkite, the most trusted man in America. On the contrary, since a testy Watergate-era exchange with Richard Nixon in 1971, Dan Rather had steadily become synonymous on the political right with liberal bias in the news media. So it was especially notable that it was he, on David Letterman's late-night talk show 6 days after the 9/11 attacks, who lined up behind the conservative Republican commander-in-chief, no matter what.
I couldn't feel stronger, David, that this is a time for us, and I'm not preaching about it. George Bush is the president. He makes the decisions. And, you know, it's just one American. Wherever he wants me to line up, just tell me where.
Yikes. Suspending journalistic independence in the name of patriotism before a live studio audience. Alas, this declaration of submission foreshadowed 2 years of the media's largely uncritical acceptance of Bush administration's claims leading to the Iraq War and beyond, the phantom weapons of mass destruction, for example. Much of the U.S. media, led by the New York Times, allowed themselves to be suckered by disinformation from Vice President Dick Cheney and other administration figures, who then brandished Times reports as having uncovered the terrifying secrets. The press would go on to regurgitate fantasy accounts of battlefield valor. Remember PFC Jessica Lynch's gunblazing capture and rescue and Corporal Pat Tillman's heroic death under enemy fire? Both were officially propagated lies. Remember Mission Accomplished? Here's how it sounded on TV.
It was an impressive sight from the deck of the Abraham Lincoln, this wartime president coming in at about 150 miles an hour.
It was quite an arrival. On board the aircraft carrier.
This whole photo op was carried off with military precision.
He became the first U.S. president ever to land on an aircraft carrier in a jet.
That was 8 years, $1 trillion, more than 4,000 American military deaths, and countless thousands of dead Iraqis ago. All of this credulous reporting, it is now all too clear, because the press wanted to be like Dan Rather on the right side of a good fight. The freedom-loving side. Except that our freedom hinges on the press being free and freely willing to question authority. When the WMDs failed to materialize, when an insider debunked the Yellowcake hoax, when Abu Ghraib pictures emerged, when civil liberties were trampled, the quiescent media were finally awakened from their spell to do their real patriotic duty. Thus did they uncover one administration outrage after another, as well as shed precious light on the complexities of war, geopolitics, domestic politics, corruption, and democracy itself. For his part, and in a deep irony, Dan Rather would be hastened into retirement after an exposé about George Bush's own version of patriotic duty. This was so-called Rathergate, the newsman's controversial story alleging that the future president shirked National Guard commitments in the Vietnam era. Though no evidence has ever been produced challenging Rather's premise, the poster boy for liberal bias was caught supporting the allegation with a forged document and soon thereafter was replaced as CBS anchor. So, yes, being duped can be a career-ending offense. But not necessarily. Not if bloody war is in the air, and you're merely following the leader. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Nazanin Rafsanjani. This week's show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rob Granis.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.